Maybe it's the last night. Yeah, catch and store energy is our principle number two. This is unit four. This is a key principle, and this is the thing that I want you to think about very, very deeply, is in natural systems, there is energy flowing through them at all times. Sun, the rain, flow of materials, of soils, of dust, particles of nutrients, flowing through systems all the time. And our question as permaculture designers is, how do we trap these? How do we catch, hold on to them and steer them towards our productive and intended outcomes? Enjoy. When the world was designed with this and that, I was young, didn't know to hold it back. Now we're here in the world, something else. We could leave any day and call for help. We were gods, nobody was above me. The A on my chest like a Dolce. The A on my chest, put your fist up. The A on my chest like a chipmunk. Alvin, Theodore, breathe in, breathe out. Me and more, breathe in, breathe out. Never mind, it was time. Number nine, love my lies, feline, with a death wish. Be right, didn't help shit. No name on the guest list. So if you have your the lesson four webpage open, the headline picture is of the carbon cycle. So let's just unpack that for a little moment. I want you to look at this image and think about how the tree, in a very simple way, captures and stores the energy from the sun and then translates that into a long-term storage. This is how, you know, basic lessons from observing nature is a plant, the only energy that it's got to run on, remember, is what's coming in from the sun, what's photosynthesizing. So again, think about that idea of this flow. So the trees, the plants, they create as much surface area as they possibly can with their leaves, by growing up tall, reaching out to the light, creating surface area, creating edges, creating membranes so that we can interact with firstly the warmth, the humidity, and the actual energy of the sunlight. As the tree grows, it converts some, it uses some of that energy. The tree is using a lot of the energy that it's trapping to feed all the other constituents of the tree's ecology. It's pumping sugars down to its roots to feed soil bacteria, mycorrhizal fungi. It's allowing the sugars in its leaves, in its fruits, in its flowers to enable the distribution of its seeds, and to feed the a community of species, the birds, insects, the whatever that are living within the tree. Now, those aren't necessarily net losses to the tree, because as the birds and insects, let's say, within the tree are feasting on the sugars made available to them, they're also living and dying, and their droppings and their manure are contributing to the quality of the soil. So actually the tree over time is breaking down, it's harvesting this energy, available energy from the sun, feeding all the constituent components within its ecosystem. And over time, it's building up a healthy soil. So think about how it's fulfilling multiple functions, and yet this key function that underpinning it is the tree's managing to catch and store, to accumulate energy over time. And that increases then the possibility and dynamism of that ecosystem. So, David Holmgren's icon, the little picture that supports, that helps us remember this very important principle, is that of a sun inside a bottle. And I like that metaphor, reminding us that it's very much solar energy that we're running on. And, you know, what's jam or bottled fruit or preserved dried produce? It's solar energy that's being captured and retained for future use. So that again is very much the theme of this lesson. And also thinking about the future use thing is, what we're trying to do is to capture and store energy so that we can build capacity so that the system itself can grow. Remember that as well. And using our observation, the observation that I really want us to be honing and working on from the first principle, is using our observation, we need to look around and identify any organic matter, any materials lying around, passing through, if you like, our homesteads that we can grab hold of. And maybe we can compost them. Maybe we can incorporate them into productive systems, into our keyhole beds, or they could become part of the feeding cycles for chickens and other livestock. Catch and store, hold on to that energy. Let's try and bring it into our local cycle. So we're just looking now at a picture of the little compost bin that we have at Dragons, at my home in Wales. So we have a little shop. We have a little gift shop. Obviously, it's not open at the moment, COVID-19 lockdown. But we help distribute Whole Foods to our neighbours. We bulk buy Whole Foods, and we end up with a lot of cardboard boxes. They don't necessarily always lend themselves for recycling. And what we do is we tear them all up, we soak them with rainwater, and we put them in a big composting unit. We add a little bit of food waste occasionally, or a little bit of urine or something like that. And what we find is it breaks down to give us a really lovely, rich compost. So again, here's my sort of icon, my idea, if you like, to help you remember catch and store energy, is also to think about these very simple composting methods and strategies we can do that allow us, you know, to facilitate this process. Okay. So there's a little underneath there, we see three green buttons. The first is just a reminder, if you have not downloaded Small and Slow Solutions, our in-course text yet, then please do. It's just 12 megabytes. It can sit on your phone and you can use it as a, you have it there to fall back on. And we're actually looking at unit three. In catch and store energy, unit three in the book. So perhaps I should revise the titles of these things that they're the same. But we're going to really get down and think a lot about soil in this, and then I'm also going to think about how soil and water and landscape interact with each other. And then I'm going to take you through a really fantastic example of sort of permaculture techniques, if you like, applied in Morocco. In high mountains, the High Atlas. And interestingly, in a community, ideas applied by a community that I'm sure are not using the word permaculture to describe what they're doing. But because they're responding to exactly the same forces, biological realities, physics that we are. So they've drawn what's interesting is to see how they've drawn the same conclusions, perhaps over actually hundreds of years. Of actual work. So we can pause a minute if you like, if you want to just download the slideshow Catch and Store Energy. That should open in a new window for you, and we can get right into that. The PDF is, I think it's only 6 megabytes, I believe, so it shouldn't be too frightening. If you do Control L, you can go into full screen mode. And straight into thinking a bit about soil. So water, soil, water and landscape, catch and store energy, that's what I've titled this presentation. There's a lot of ideas in this, so we might need to take a break somewhere in the middle. Okay, let's go back to the tree. Let's go back to this process of photosynthesis. This is the building block of life on Earth. This is the building block of the nutrient cycles that we ourselves are part of. And so we can see photosynthesis of the tree, grabbing hold of carbon dioxide, using the carbon to build sugars, also to build the structure of the tree, and releasing the oxygen because it doesn't actually need it. And then that oxygen then is then available for other species to use. So the tree, if you think about it, as it develops over time, it's more branches, more mass, more leaves, more surface area. So it's using this carbon dioxide to store carbon in biomass. Obviously, the tree now has a lifespan. At some point, it would fall down and die, and a lot of that carbon potentially might return back to the atmosphere. But so you could say this is a kind of a short cycle return, although the tree itself might live hundreds of years. Now let's think a little bit more. Within that tree, we've got a interesting ecology of different species, things that will be eating the buds and laying their eggs in the tree and nesting in it and so forth. And to a large extent, the birds and the insects self-regulate themselves. So no insect should take over and own that whole ecosystem, because it should just become food for other elements that then obviously help regulate that numbers. In the process of this feeding cycle on and within the tree, then we're seeing actually nutrients also cycling and being deposited on the soils and actually changing and energizing those surface layers of the soil. What we see in this diagram is called the O horizon, which is the part of the soil. Let's just pause for a second and think. As we dig down below the surface, as we go down, the quality, the texture, the type, the sort of characteristics of the soil tend to change. So at the surface, at what we call the O horizon, there's a lot of organic materials there. There's a lot of air, there's at least maybe 50% air. There's a lot of, by volume, there's a lot of soil organisms busy breaking down, dead leaves, breaking down the dead insects and whatever else. And all of this sort of process creates humus. And as the humus develops, it becomes increasingly stable and it starts to maintain long-term fertility in the soil. Now, over time, imagine this, the roots of the tree reach deeper down into the ground, anchor roots, the tap roots seeking for water. Maybe the roots of companion plants growing with the tree might be deep rooted, accessing deep down minerals, depositing them on the surface. So as those plants live and die, as the root matter of the tree sort of waxes and wanes, carbon is being deposited ever deeper down in the soil. It's this idea of translocation. So you can imagine that in the winter there's a lot of leaf fall and worms and insects and things pull that carbon matter down into the soil, and then over time different layers of the ecology and then the living and dying of the tree itself means that some of that carbon reaches lower and lower down into the soil, where it becomes more and more stable, and it's going to stay there for a longer and longer time. So we'll get a little bit more into soil structure in the next couple of slides. But this first idea is thinking about how carbon migrates through the system. A lot of it's constantly in cycle, but actually through the interaction of trees and plants and animals, some of that carbon is grabbed hold of and increasingly gets locked up long-term, firstly in the surface area layers of the soil, and then laterally in the deeper layers of the soil. This is a good thing. This is something that we want to happen. It turns out that the more carbon there is in the soil, the better the soil can accept and hold on to rainwater. And obviously that's key for the new nourishment of our plants. So our next slide, we've got a hand-drawn sort of sketch of soil horizons. And just to take us beneath the surface. Now I'm going to touch on the difference between temperate and tropical soils in the next slide, but just for a moment, I'm trying to think about the commonality of it all. So, well, what they called the O horizon in the previous slide is this top part of the soil is a mixture of living plants and the debris of plants that have died recently. We can see a jumble there of plants and insects. You can see the roots of the tree and think about how much all of that organic matter is so important for the percolation of rainwater, so that the surface area, this mulch, this both living and dead plant matter on the surface of the soil is like a big sponge. So when it rains, 3 inches of leaf litter on the soil can absorb and hold an inch of rain. And if you can absorb and hold the rain on the surface of the ground, then it gives it time to slowly seep in and percolate in down. Rainwater follows the channels opened up by roots, by cracks in rocks, and slowly it'll permeate and trickle down until it reaches right down to the bedrock. Now again, we get different kinds of soils depending on whether that bedrock is porous, whether it lets the water carry on seeping down, or whether it's it's impervious. It's not porous. In other words, the water then can't go down, and the lower levels start to become waterlogged. So we can also imagine that when we get down to the sort of the sea horizon, in this diagram, is as we get deeper down, that soil is going to be more saturated. It's going to be a lot less oxygen. It's going to tend to be more anaerobic, and it'll have different kinds of soil organisms living in it. Whereas in the A horizon up at the top, it's much more aerobic and full of organisms that, just like ourselves, breathe in oxygen and breathe out CO2. So again, that just reiterates really the importance of how open, aerated soils, how important that is to the soil life. So here's a really interesting thought, though, that I'm going to kind of give you and make you think about sort of the dynamic nature of the way that the natural world works. Is we all know that large bodies of water respond to the pull of the moon, of the gravitational force of the moon, that they tend to, will be drawn towards the moon, which means that they sort of well up slightly in the shape of that sort of, we've seen the tides rise and fall. There's much speculation, there's much insight into the idea that actually the water within the soil also responds to the pull of the moon. So we get this really interesting reality that when the moon is full and the water and the gravitational forces is strongest, then the water in the soil rises up. And that means that it will push out, exit the gases, carbon dioxide, stale gases from the respiration of the soil organisms. And then as the pull of the moon lessens, then that level of water in the soil sort of drops back down again, and allowing fresh oxygen and moisture to be drawn into the soil. So on one level, the soil's actually breathing in and out. Think about that. And think about how it's breathing in and out. It's helping nourish, but first get rid of the sort of stale air, used breakdown products of metabolism, and drawing in fresh air and fresh humidity to energize the system. So the beginning into our journey of understanding soil is to really understand the degree to which it's alive, the degree to which it's a living, breathing organism all of its own. It's like the skin of the biosphere of the living earth. It's so important in many ways. So we're going to explore the life in the soil, and that's going to be something which we'll look at very soon. One of my favorite little facts that get shared is that a good handful of healthy topsoil might contain as many microorganisms as there are people on the planet. There might be 4, 5, 6 billion organisms in, a couple of handfuls of really healthy soil. So that's the degree to which we've actually failed to understand soils by just treating it as a medium on which to put fertilizers. So that's something which we'll get into a bit later on. So our next slide, we're seeing three transects of different types of soil. We're looking at a desert soil, a temperate soil, and a tropical soil, and trying to understand perhaps how they might be different. Let's jump in and look at the temperate soil, the one in the middle first. That's the one I'm most familiar with, and something which we, conditions that we want to try and emulate where we can. And that's what typifies our temperate soils is that there's a large amount of carbon, of humus, of organic matter in the surface of the soil, in the O horizon. And that makes it very good for absorbing water, very good for holding moisture, and it makes it a very good growing environment. And it seems that a lot of the strategies that we use in permaculture seem to be about really boosting soil carbon in that topsoil layer. In fact, a lot of what we've done in Kenya and Uganda is we've constructed raised beds with a lot of organic matter in them that sit on top of the soil. So, which, if you like, is like increasing that surface depth, increasing the ability to retain moisture. That seems to be our kind of overall strategy. So there's the reality, if we just jump to the right, is for most tropical systems is most of the humus, most of the good stuff that's in the system at any one time is actually in the crops. There's much less in the soil. And that's to do with the heat and the humidity and things like that, is that organic matter just breaks down much faster in the tropics. And so the best way to capture and keep hold of your organic matter really is in living material. And again, that's why a lot of annual farming techniques, like just growing maize and then having bare soil and so forth, tend to really deplete the soils over time. And we're seeing many, many examples now in the majority world and in the tropics where farming, a few, you know, decade or two of farming have completely destroyed very fragile soils. And what we're left out with is lower levels of sort of subsoils, these B horizon soils, which tend to be full of minerals and, according to this diagram, iron oxide, aluminium oxide, and other sort of things, which actually make it very challenging for plants to grow. So we've got a couple of we've got some key differences between the temperate and the organic and the tropic. Temperate and tropical soils, and that is the temperate soils have much more humus, and that humus is breaking down and cycling much more slowly, which allows it to build up. In the tropics, it doesn't do that so much, and we have an accelerated if it's sort of carbon cycle because of the heat and humidity. So we approach these with slightly different strategies, but at the end of the day we're all trying to achieve the same things. If we jump over to the first one, where we're looking at a desert soil, and what we notice in the desert soil is there is no O horizon, there is no organic living layer on the surface because it's just too arid, it's too hot, it's too dry, there's not enough materials to support that life. And we get very strong mineral pans forming underneath the desert soils because there's no roots going down to break it up, and there's no penetration of rain and so forth. So there's a sort of a broad classifications of soil, but I'm going to go into a slightly more, let's go into a simpler, more visual way to classify our soils. And if we move on to the next slide, just slide 5 of the series, we're seeing a comparison of particle sizes of minerals. So how do we describe soils? How, if we were to feel one or touch one, how might we describe it? What language might we use to, what adjectives might we use? And often people refer to soil as by its texture. Clay soils tend to stick together. They'd be very sticky, heavy, and you can form a ball in your hand and it sticks together. You can roll it into a sausage even and flex it in it, and it doesn't break up. The more it does that, the higher the proportion of clay in your soil. The other end of the spectrum are soils that are sandy, soils that when you rub your fingers through them, you can feel the mineral particles within them. And somewhere in between lies silty soils, and silt particles are actually still a lot smaller than sand particles. Now, a lot of soils are made up of mixtures of the three, of silt, sand, and clay, and it gives us something which we call a loam, especially when it has a really good biological content, that the soil, but there's much organic matter in there as well. So I just think for a moment is, A sandy soil, the larger the rock particles, the more air there's going to be in the soil. There's going to be more gaps there's going to be between those particles, if you imagine that. And that's a really good thing. That means that the soil's free draining, it's got a lot of air within it, and there's a lot of potential for microbial life. The downside of that, if you like, is that because it's free draining, is that nutrients that are in the soil tend to get washed through and either end up much deeper down out of reach of the plants, or they might get washed away into rivers and things like that. And if we contrast that with a clay soil, is that clay soils are heavy, they are wet, they do the opposite of what sands, they don't allow water to drain. If they're baked in the sun, they go almost you know, like brick, and then it's impossible then for rainwater to infiltrate. But because they're not porous and they're not constantly allowing water to flow through them, clay soils tend to accumulate nutrients. So clay soils tend to be quite fertile. And so there's a very simple visualization for you. If you want to help, if you like to see numbers, let's just jump to the next slide. I pulled this out of Bill Mollison's Designer's Manual book. We define clay particles as being less than 0.002 millimeters, or somewhere on a range between that and 0.002. So we've got less than, okay, that's what we mean. Okay, so clay particles are really, really small, basically. Look, the salt particles take us up to by a factor of 10, and fine and coarse sand could be anything up to 2 millimeters in diameter. So there we go. We have some numbers to go with those images. And then here's a nice little graphic on the next slide, slide 7, that a student put together for us many years ago, which I just liked, which was a little sort of checklist of how to approach and look after your soil. So identify what soil you have, and think about how you can nourish it to improve. You can always improve your soil. There's no upper limit to what you can do. Okay, so one way to see what your soil is like is just dig a handful from just below the surface. Just go down underneath perhaps the immediate root layer, just at the bottom of the, between the O horizon and the A horizon, and take a handful of soil and fill it about, so it fills about a third full of a glass jar, something that you can see through, or a cup or something, but something you can see through. Plastic bottle is also fine as well, of course. And then top it up almost sort of 4/5 full of water and give it a really good shake. Really, really, really good shake. Agitate it till everything's in suspension, all the particles. So it just looks like a muddy, you know, muddy bottle of water. Then you can stand it on a surface and watch it. And what you'll find is that the heavy, if you've got any stones in there, if you've got any coarse gravel, coarse sand, bits of gravel, that those are going to just precipitate out immediately, and you'll see them forming at the bottom. So you'll see your large particles dropping out of the bottom very, very quickly. And then slowly, sand, any sort of smaller, less coarse sand particles will also deposit out. And you'll have that as a sort of like a geological strata almost at the bottom of your jam jar. It might take a little bit longer for the silt particles to sediment out. And then you're looking into the water and ask yourself, is it clear or is it muddy? And if the soil is still really quite muddy, even after a few minutes, the chances are you're looking at quite a clay-rich soil, because the clay particles are so small that they can remain in suspension, sometimes for days. So you're then getting a real sense of the different qualities of these particles, of these organic particles, mineral particles, and how that might relate to the soil quality. But here's also a thing that you can think about, is that when you're looking at into your jam jar, and again, I would encourage you to do this lots of times in different places, because then you get to see the patterns, you start to see, because you've got nothing to compare it to. And the first time you do it, you're not quite sure, you know, what you're looking at. So it's good to, wherever you go, you know, have a play, explore, observe and interact with the soils. And then organic particles, organic matter might sit on top of the clay eventually, and you might have some bits of stick or whatever floating on the top. So the question is, how long does it take before that water goes really clear again? Is it a day or two? Is it many days? And that's really telling you about how much clay is in the soil and the proportion of those different rock particles that make it up. Okay, so we move on quickly to slide 9. And this is this is the USDA Department of Agriculture classification for soil types by particle size. You have this lovely diagram, this triangle. You may well have seen it before. So each one of the three points are the extremes of soil that we might imagine. So one is 100% clay, or 100% silt, 100% sand. In reality, nearly all soils are mixed up a bit, and you've got a bit, you might have a loamy sand or sandy loam. And this diagram actually just defines what we mean by those terms. And it's really, again, just referring to the proportion of the particle size of the mineral part of your soil. And you'll notice that in the middle we have this loam, clay loam. This word loam is, that's where we want to get. That's the target. We want a crumbly open soil that's mixed up particle size and very high biological and humus and compost sort of component within it. That's what we're looking for. And what we've learned is that by good soil management, good techniques, keeping soils covered, using lots of compost, using a lot of biological action to energize soils, is you can get any soil to be a good loam. You just got to work with it. There's rules and there's things to know, but it's always possible to do it. Okay, so let's stay with that. And one of the ways that it happens, if you're just moving on now quickly to slide 10, is imagine your mineral particles, your little clay pieces, your little small pieces of sand or something in your soil. That soil is constantly being interacted with by things like microbes, fungi, and earthworms. And they actually create a kind of a glue, if you like, from their biological processes that aggregate, stick together these tiny little soil particles and watch them become what we call crumbs. And again, when we're looking at a soil to see whether it's really healthy and full of life, what we're looking for is its crumb structure. We want it to be not just little bits of mineral particles. What we're looking for is to see how they've been stuck together, aggregated together into crumbs. And that's a product of the biological life in the soil that's doing that for you. Imagine bits of soil passing through the gut of an earthworm. It's coming out the other end and it's all kind of stuck together with the various digestive products and the bacteria and things like that. So so think about soil very much as a living thing. Slide 11 is a exploration of how roots and soil interact with each other. And one thing we want to say for starters is try not to imagine the root as something that's barging its way down, so drilling its way into the soil, because that's not really what happens. Is that the roots will flow into soil and seek out cracks and seek out little fissures. They don't want to, especially the fine hairs on roots are very, very fragile, and they don't want to be damaged and scratched, because obviously that could be a route in for infection. So imagine more the roots of a plant worming their way into the cracks, and as they grow, they swell, and they sort of extend and make these cracks sort of larger. They're working the soil, but they're also anchoring the soil. They're also preventing it from being eroded away or and making it much more stable. So there's a two-way, very interesting two-way interaction going on between the roots and the soil. And what we can see also is there's water droplets within the soil, but the soil's not saturated. And that's, again, is absolutely ideal. Most of the actual nutrition that the plants are getting is coming from these soil microbes. As I say, especially in this O horizon and the A horizon of the soil, these are aerobic actions. So fungi and bacteria in these environments, like us, breathing in oxygen, breathing out CO2. And in the process of them decomposing and breaking down organic matter, they then make those nutrients available to the plant. And in return, the plant makes sugars and other things available to the soil microbes. So there's a really delicate interchange going on at the root level. Now, this next slide, you might just want to, I'm putting my glasses on. This is taken down a telescope, a microscope rather, looking down deeper into the soil. And we're seeing the complexity of a soil crumb, if you like, one of those aggregated clumps of soil that we saw before. So you can see the rock particles, the mineral part of the soil is there. But look how, interestingly, how the spaces between those rock particles are. They're just full of life. So over on the left-hand side of the picture, we can see a plant root, we can see a root hair, and we can see how that is sort of holding onto the soil around it. But then also, really interestingly, we're seeing mycorrhizal hyphae. That's these threads, these little white threads of fungi that are actually growing into the plant. And in one direction, the mycorrhizal hyphae is bringing minerals with it, and the plant's literally digesting it. It's actually eating the fungi as it's growing into the plant. And in return, sugars and other nutrients are flowing from the plant into the mycorrhizal fungi. So there's a nutrient exchange going on at a cellular level within the soil. We're seeing actinomycete hyphae and spores, different soil organisms. And we're seeing there that it's that actinomycete is surrounding and digesting some decomposing plant cells. And there's an amoeba there as well, another little unicellular organism that's feasting on that sort of detritus field. We can see little microscopic nematode worms and fungal hyphae and spores. And you can see how now this web of biological activity is knitting together these soil particles to create this crumb structure, this lovely thing that plants enjoy so much. Slide 13 is we're seeing this is really worth looking at, really worth thinking about. So this is a pine seedling, pine tree seedling, and the brown that you're looking at is the roots of the plant. So there it is, anchoring itself in the soil and trying to create some surface area, some edge, so that it can, trade nutrients with the soil. But all of those white dots, those white nodes on the roots of the plant, that's the mycorrhizal fungi. Those are the node points where the fungi is attaching itself onto and working with the pine tree seedling. And then you can see the mycorrhizal, the hyphae of the fungi, is that sort of the white mass. So, and look how it breaks down into smaller and smaller and smaller little tubules. So this association between the fungi and the plant is increasing the surface area of the plant roots by a factor of thousands. So this goes to show that very much this idea of symbiosis, very much this idea about the partnership between organisms within the soil that actually develop and maintain fertility, but also allow then the transfer of that fertility from the soil to the plant. Okay, and actually from the plant through the mycorrhizal fungi, they can send out antibodies and water and nutrients. They can actually connect to other trees and other plants through that network as well. So again, really challenging our idea of just thinking about a single crop in a field and with a single idea of just growing, let's say, maize. What this module is bringing us into really is the realization of the dynamic complexity of the natural world and how these different species all interact. Now, if we just jump into the final slide before we have a little break. I've gone over time. This what we're looking at, this crazy thing, it looks like, I don't know, it looks like spaghetti noodles and a meatball or something. This is at the heart of the mycorrhizal fungi. This is the node, and you can see these are the hypha, the fungal hypha, that go out and create the surface area, create those associations that are happening within the soil. All of this is what we're trying to bear in mind as we're working with our soils. Thank you very much for listening to this section, and we'll be back with the next one very soon. And never, see, now I just wanna live forever.